ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। पशुवत् यवन एष नियमाना स्वकं क्षयम् अन्वजावाननुपता शोचन्तो विश्वम् आतुराः। Translation: when the Yavanas were taking King Puranjana away to their place, binding him like an animal, the king's followers became greatly aggrieved. While they lamented, they were forced to go along with him. Purport: when Yamaraj and his assistants take a living entity away to the place of judgment, the life, life heir, and desires, being followers of the living entity, also go with him. This is confirmed in the Vedas. When the living entity is taken away or arrested by Yamaraj, tam utkramantam, the life heir also goes with him. Prano anutkramati. When the life heir is gone, pranam anutkramantam, all the senses, sarve pranaha, also go along, anutkramanti. When the living entity and life heir are gone, the lump of matter produced of five elements, earth, water, fire, and ether, is rejected and left behind. The living entity then goes to the court of judgment, and Yamaraj decides what kind of body he is going to get next. This process is unknown to modern scientists. Every living entity is responsible for his activities in this life, and after death he is taken to the court of Yamaraj, where it is decided what kind of body he will take next. Although the gross material body is left, the living entity and his desires, as well as the resultant reactions of his past activities, go on. It is Yamaraj who decides what kind of body one gets in accordance with one's past actions. Srila Prabhupada ki? So what's being said here is that Esha, he, Puranjan, was Niyamana. He was led, Yavanai, by the Yavanas, Pashuvat, like an animal. Swakam Kshayam, and he was taken to their Swakam Kshayam, their abode. And then at that time, Anupata, the Anupatas, his followers, Anvadravan, they ran after him or they followed him, and they were Atura, they were greatly disturbed, immensely distressed, and Shochanto Brisham, they were crying and lamenting greatly. So Puranjana was, he passed away, he left his body, and as the Yamadutas came and bound him up and dragged him to his next destination, to the abode of Yamaraj, at that time the followers of the king, they also went along. They also went along for the ride, and they were greatly distressed seeing their master taken away from them. Okay. Just as a disclaimer, this is the first time I've ever given class in Vrindavan. It's slightly intimidating. Of course, all the great Vaishnavas are here, but it's also a very special place. And we're sitting at the feet of Prabhupada, and it's big deal in my life. If I do a good job, you can let me know, and then it'll be one of my great achievements in this lifetime. And if I do a bad job, it'll be one of many failures in my lifetime. Okay, so because I'm new here, I just wanted to get a little bit of context where we're at in the Bhagavatam and what's going on in this particular pastime. So I'm not going to spend too much time because I know that many of you have been following for months and years the class, but I'm expecting that there are some guests like myself. And so although we may not all know the story of Paranjana, it's still always beneficial to start with the broadest scope and then hone in on the verse and get more and more detail as we move in. So I guess we can start just, there's a natural context of the Bhagavatam right now. There's a conversation which was started in the third canto between Vidura and Maitreya. And that conversation takes two cantos. It spans over three cantos, the third, fourth, and fifth canto, but you can say all together it's like it's a full two cantos. And so Maitreya is the guru, Vidura is the disciple, he's asking questions, he's posing questions. And they start off, just after the world was created, they start off and Vidura is asking about how is it possible that Manu created when the earth was deluged and it was submerged. And so it's the earth is in the garbo duck, and how is it possible that progeny was created? And so then there's a whole narrative that goes along with that, the story of Rahadev, which makes Vidura completely ecstatic, and he wants more details about the story. And so they go through again, you get Jai and Vijay, you get a retelling of the same story, a little more detail, a little different flavor. And then they can begin to describe the creation of progeny from Manu. So Manu has five children. Dapup, D-A-P-U-P. Devahuti, Akuti, Prasuti, Utanpad, and Priyabrat. Good way to remember it. So he starts off with Devahuti, who married Kardam. They had Kapil. Again, the Lord's pastimes common. The whole purpose of the Bhagavatam is Govinde Labhate Ratim, to give devotion to Govinda. So in many ways, the Bhagavatam is a collection of pastimes where Krishna appears in the lives of his great devotees and saves them and helps them in various wonderful, miraculous ways. And so in many ways, the Bhagavatam is simply a beautiful necklace of such pastimes of the Lord coming into the lives of his devotees and affecting them. So Kapildev, he teaches Jnana and Sankhya from a Bhagavat point of view. And then that's done, and the fourth canto begins. And then Akuti, who had Yajna and Dattatreya, Yajna gets touched on later on the eighth canto. And then Prasuti comes up. And Prasuti, one of their progeny was Sati, who married Shiva, and the whole Daksha Yajna comes out of that. And then after that, you get on to Utanpad, and you get the story of Dhruva, Venu, Prithumaj, all in the genealogy, all in the pranali coming from Utanpad. And then you get Barhishat, the Prachetas, and then you go back to Prachina Barhi. This Barhishat, he was Prachina Barhi because he was always doing yajnas. Prachina means Eastern, and so this Barhishat was always doing yajnas, and therefore he became famous as Prachina Barhishat, Prachina Barhi. And then he met Narad Muni, who felt some obligation to help him because he's in the family of his disciple, Dhruv Maharaj, but he'd become too materialistic, and so he told him the story of Paranjana. And the king became inspired. His life changed for the better. He became perfect. And then the Prachetas, who were doing some austerities, they had already had an interaction with Lord Shiva, and they came back and took over. And then at the end of the canto, in the fifth canto, the story of Priyavrata. So this whole Devahuti, Akuti, Utanpad, Devahuti, Akuti, Prasuti, Utanpad, Priyavrata, that helps you through two cantos. And this is the most important context of the Bhagavatam because it's the direct context given in the text itself. So it provides us with a first, if we want to understand the Bhagavatam, the 18,000 verses of the Bhagavatam, this is a great place to start. You carefully look at the chapters and how they're strung together. One time I asked Radha Govinda Maharaj, Vrindavan's Radha Govinda Maharaj, the famous Radha Govinda Maharaj, I said, you know, I've been studying the Gita for a couple of decades now, and I feel like I've understood it to some extent, but the Bhagavatam is so massive. How do you get a handle on it? How can you understand the Bhagavatam? And Radha Govinda Maharaj said to me, in our temple in Laguna Beach, he said the Bhagavatam is very easy to understand. And he proceeded to, from memory, go over all 335 chapters of the Bhagavatam in order and explain the connections between all the chapters. what an amazing thing. And I told this to Radha Raman Maharaj and his younger brother. And I was sort of stunned when I was telling him. And he said, yeah, I saw him do that in Orisha. He was doing like some Bhagavat Saptaha, and he would normally pick one or two subjects, Dhruv Charita or Prahlad Charita, and he would talk about that. But the people became a little antsy, they became a little agitated, and around day five or six, they said, hey, we want to hear everything, or we want to hear the 10th canto. So Maharaj, like in a, I don't want to say in a frustrated mood, but Maharaj just one afternoon goes, okay, you want to hear the whole Bhagavatam? And he just, whole Bhagavatam, all 335 chapters from memory in front of a crowd of 10,000 people. So we can study the Bhagavatam, we get some context. There's another thing we can use to say the Bhagavatam, and that is that the particular canto we're in right now is on Visarga. So there's Atra, Sarga, Visarga. So there's 10 subjects of the Bhagavatam listed in the Bhagavatam. Again, it's a legend. Like in a map, you get a legend, and then by looking at the legend and looking at the map, you know that 1 inch equals 1 mile, or you know the star is a capital, and a circle is a city, and a big circle is a city of over 1 million people. So you look at the legend, and then when you look at the map, it makes sense. So the Bhagavatam gives us a legend in the beginning, in the second canto. And so according to that legend, we are now in Visarga, which is subsequent creation. The Lord creates the world, Sarga, and then the world has to be populated, Visarga. And so Visarga is a subsequent creation. Sarga is the emanation of the universe from Karna Dakashai Vishnu, and the initial kind of things are put into place, and then Visarga is the subsequent creation by the Manus, by Brahma, etc. And so that also, it's very clear the genealogies, the Prachetas are creating, Prajapati Daksha is creating, everybody's creating. It's sort of at the beginning of the world and everybody's creating. So that also helps us to understand the section we're in. Barhishat, all these great personalities, they're all Prajapatis. They're all big personalities who are given the task of, sometimes my friends call me Prajapati because I have 5 kids. Which used to be kind of normal, maybe 50 years ago, but in today's nuclear families, 5 kids is a lot. So sometimes my friends, they joke with me, oh, you're like a Prajapati. Of course, if you read the Bhagavatam, I'm not a Prajapati. These personalities did amazing things, phenomenal things. So, in Kali Yuga, you maintain a family, and that's like some kind of great achievement. The third tool that we can use to understand where we are in the Bhagavatam right now is that the Bhagavatam is a commentary on Vedanta Sutra. And normally we say, because it starts out with the words Jamadi Yasya Yataha, and it finishes with Kirtan, that's kind of, usually that's about all that we do when we're trying to unpack this. But this is something that all of our acharyas have said repeatedly, and something Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said repeatedly. And so it's a pretty significant part of our tradition, that the Bhagavatam is a commentary on Vedanta Sutra. So of course, to understand how that's so, you have to read Vedanta Sutra, because without knowing Vedanta Sutra, then you can't fit in how the Bhagavatam is a commentary. Anyway, one thing Vedanta does is it critiques and co-opts all of the various darshans which were prevalent in India at the time it was put together. And so there's these Sadarshans, there's Purvamimamsa, and Uttaramimamsa, that's Vedanta, and there's Nyaya and Vaisheshika, and then there's Sankhya and Yoga. And so Vedanta critiques these various darshans, and then takes the essence of them and puts it together into a samanvaya. So one of the major features of the fourth canto, and again, these first two tools are directly from the Bhagavatam, there's no question. This tool requires a little bit more creativity. The idea that we should look at Vedanta and we should see the Bhagavatam as a commentary, that idea is given in our Shastra. But exactly how to do that, that requires some creativity. And so we find in the fourth canto that yajna is the prominent theme. Proper yajna and improper yajna. Daksha, he does bad yajna and he's punished for it. Prithu Maharaj does good yajna, right? Vena Maharaj, he thinks he's like Yajnapati, and that doesn't work out so well for him. He tells everybody, you should do yajnas to me. And it, like I said, that he's finished. That's the beginning of the end for him. Dhruva Maharaj did proper yajna. He lost his cool for a minute when his brother Uttam was killed by the Yakshas, but then he took good instruction and he went back and did proper yajna. The Prachetas, they do yajna. Barishat was famous for doing yajna. So if you look at the fourth canto, it's filled with purvamimamsa, with yajna. It's filled with karmakanda. The right way to do it and the wrong way to do it. And Vedanta includes that. Shishi Goranataki, Shishi Krishna Balaramki, Shishi Radha Sham Sundar Lalita Visaki, Vishaka. So, I think that also helps us to get a handle on where we are. Barishat did a bunch of yajnas, and when you do yajnas, you kill animals. And there was a whole massive revolt against the killing of animals in the Vedic culture. There was a massive revolt. And there's two versions of it. There's the Astik version and the Nastik version. There's people who went back into the Vedas and they found that in addition to the instructions for animal slaughter, were simultaneous instructions that you should not kill animals. And simultaneous instruction that the real yajna was within. Simultaneous, like Manusmriti, for instance, says that you can sacrifice an animal made out of dough and water instead of a real animal. The Upanishads, which are part of the Shruti, the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, for instance, takes the idea of the Ashwamedha yajna, which is such a critical feature of the Samhitas and the Brahmanas. And it says actually this is all intended as a symbol. And there's a cosmic Ashwamedha yajna that's going on, where Prajapati, where the Purusha is giving of himself, and he is the sacrificial animal, and he's giving to the world, very similar to the Purusha Sukta. And so some people went back to the Veda, and they found within it a deeper teaching, a more profound teaching. And they explicated that. In many ways, you can see that the Gita is that. Some devotees know, other devotees don't. Katha Upanishad, Mundaka Upanishad, Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, Chandogya Upanishad. They're all mentioned in the Gita, direct verses taken from those shastras. And Krishna takes those verses and he clarifies their meaning. He explains them. He nuances their understanding. And so that's the original father of Veda, clarifying the meaning because the meaning was lost. And there's that whole thing about the pushpitam vacham, the flowery language for Veda Vada Ratas, for people who are attached to the Vedas, and where Bhog Aishwarya Prasaktam attached to opulence and enjoyment. And there's Swarga Gatim and there's Swarga Pra, they want to go to heaven. Samadhal Navitiyate, they don't find Samadhi. They're not able to find Samadhi. The whole preface of the Bhagavad Gita is actually this point. Triguna Vishaya Veda. Nishtragunya Bhavarjuna. There's something called transitive logic. A equals B, B equals C, A equals B, B equals C, therefore A equals C. Transitive logic. Real simple. So, Tri Guna Vishaya Veda. The Vedas are about the three gunas. Tri Guna Vishaya. Vishaya. The subject of the Vedas is Tri Guna, the three gunas. Nishtrigunyo. Nishtrigunya Bhava Arjuna. Bhava is in imperative mood. It means be, O Arjuna, be Nishtrigunya. Be free from the three gunas. So if the Vedas are about the three gunas, and you should transcend the three gunas, what should you transcend? That's his opening gambit. That's Krishna's opening line. That's in the second chapter, early on. That's his introduction to the subject of the Gita. So if you dig back into Veda, and you find that transcendent subject explicated, albeit a little bit cryptically, you're astik. You're astik. That's the Upanishads. That's the Vaishnava tradition. If you go back into the Veda and you find it's all about bad stuff and you reject it, that's Gnostic. That's the Buddhists. That's the Jains. That's Tantra to a large extent. Yoga is sort of half in and half out. Depending on the point, they're kind of half in and half out. But the various schools of thought, you can categorize them very nicely. They're all rebelling. It's all a revival movement. Or it's a heresy, depending on which place you're looking from. But people were dissatisfied with the materialism of the Veda. And they wanted to find something more spiritual. And sometimes they felt like they had to go outside the tradition, sometimes they felt like they could stay within the tradition. Anyway, that's something about yoga. I've got more to say, but I realize I'm giving too much context. All right, final. Well, one last thing. You take a look at the original yajna, and you're taking ghee, which represented amrit, which represented water, and you're offering that ghee into the fire by the mantra, which is air. And you're taking these primary elements, which are the gift of God to us, and in the cycle of rita, you're giving them back, and you're creating a great chakra, like Krishna mentions in the third chapter of the Gita. And so we've been given, and then we're giving back, and there's a cycle of reciprocity between man and God. And that's the cycle of rita, which is such a critical concept in the ancient Vedic literature. And so that, in texts like the Hatha Yoga, in it's like the Hatha Yoga text, that external yajna of the major elements being offered in sacrifice, it becomes internalized. And then you have your ida and your pingala. You have your fire and your water inside yourself. And then through prana again, as pranayama, then you do an internal yajna. And the external yajna is internal. Very similar to how the Upanishads treat it. We get that. And the yajna becomes Sankirtan yajna. And the same principle of yajna, of offering something back, is continued through millennia. And instead of going outside of that, it's given new life. It's revived, some essence of it, some sweetness in it that was perhaps neglected at a certain point in time. Anyway, this is Mahaprabhu's reading of Veda when he was speaking with Chankazi. This is our understanding. It's why there's the Brahma Sanhita. It's a Sanhita literature. It's the real meaning of the Veda. There's Sankirtan Yajna. It's the real yajna. We co-opt this language, and this language is our language, and we're trying to connect ourselves with that ancient tradition, and we're saying this is what the tradition was really about. One final point of context. This story of Paranjana is pratik. It's symbolic. It's paroksha. It's indirect. And so this entire story is one big, gigantic analogy and metaphor and poetic device, because Paranjana is Barhishat. But Narada's clever, And so he tells a story, and in that story, Barhishat finds himself, and the story has an effect on him. And so this story is unique in that way. It's the entire story is meant to be taken in a pratik fashion, in a symbolic fashion. Now, we have lots of symbolism in our tradition, but this is purely symbolic. For instance, Bhaktivinoda Thakur in his Chaitanya Shikshamrita, he says each one of the demons represents various anartas. But in addition to that symbolic interpretation, there's also that it's a real lila. You follow? Or like Duryodhan in the Mahabharata. Duryodhan, his name means bad fighter. So he represents an archetype as a bad fighter, as an illegitimate warrior. At the same time, there's an actual history there as well. So this story of Paranjana is unique in that it is purely meant to be taken as symbolic. Alright, so the story of Paranjana in a nutshell. Paranjana is a living entity, wanders around different species, finds a human body, marries his intelligence. The intelligence now becomes materially contaminated and starts to really enjoy and own that city, really settle into that city. Then Paranjana loses his way and engages in hunting, in illicit activity, in violent activity, disturbs his intelligence. He comes back home, and then he engages in licit activity, good, righteous, pious activity, but nonetheless material activity. And through that good karma and bad karma and mix of karma, which is the bag of his life, he passes time joyfully in this city, protected by a five-headed serpent, which is the five life heirs. And then Chanda Vega comes. Chanda Vega means moving swiftly. Vega means kind of like a stream or a flow. And Chanda means like a very passionate or forceful or quick moving. So Chanda Vega comes, and that's time. That's time from the time he spent in sexual enjoyment and romantic delights. So it's Gandharva Raj. It's Chanda Vega. He's the king of the Gandharvas, all the celestial pleasures. And his life passes by. And his five-headed protector, five-headed serpent protector, his five life heirs defends that city. But eventually it gets weakened enough. And then Yavanraj comes. Yavanraj comes to take him away. Assisted by Kalkanya, assisted by time. There's a whole interesting story there, which we'll get back to in a minute. But the daughter of time, Jara, old age, embraces Paranjana as her husband, and he now begins to die. And Yavanraj attacks the city, and everything goes to hell, and his life passes before his eyes, and then we get to where we are now, which is he's actually leaving his body. And so then the Yavanas, it says here, Yavanai. So he was Niyamana, he was he was being led away. Yavanai, by the Yavanas. But Prabhupada, he says here, when Yamaraj and his assistants, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, the Yavanas mentioned there, those are the Yamadutas. And that's where the Yamaduta thing comes from. So those Yavanas, they were the Yamadutas. So the Yavanas are the Yamadutas. They're taking him away. And then they're taking him away, Swakam Kshayam, to their own abode. And at that time, it's interesting, there's a little play on Sanskrit here. Anupatta means follower. Anu, follow, and patta, one who follows your path. So it's a play on words, because the anupatta, the followers, those who follow Paranjana's path, they anvadravan. They followed him. You follow? Because again, the same word is used twice. It's kind of a poetic device. The Bhagavatam is beautiful like that. Even when it's expressing such macabre reality, it does so in a very sweet and poetic way. Because the Bhagavatam is kavya. And they were Atura, Brisham, Shochanta. They were lamenting greatly because of their distress. So, Let's take a look at the purport now. We've done enough context. We've looked at the verse. We've located ourselves. We can now look at Prabhupada's purport, and we can understand. We can try to understand what he's saying. I'll just at this point, I'd like to make one, just because it's probably the only time I'll get to give class here this year, maybe forever. I don't know. It depends how I do for time. What time am I supposed to finish? 9? Okay. 9's normal. It's not late, right? Okay. So, this is my own opinion. If you like it, you can make it your opinion, and you can, I'm just, you know, it's uncopyrighted. It's in the free market. Feel free. Don't have to name me. Just go ahead and take it. Use it if it has any value. I think there's three kinds of ways devotees in ISKCON, in my experience, give class. And I'll just, because I think all times where people read the Bhagavatam and read Shastra, I think every time they do it, it's wonderful. So I'm going to describe them as Purna, Purnatara, and Purnatama. Or complete, more complete, and most complete. That's a way we have of making a comparison when you don't want to criticize. You say Purna, Purnatara, and Purnatama. Mahaprabhu does that in Chaitanya Charitamrita. So the first way of giving class is somebody comes and they read the verse in purport and they say whatever they want to say. They read the verse in purport and they say, yesterday I was changing rupees into dollars and a monkey and a dog were fighting and I realized the nature of the material world. And judging by the laughs, I'm guessing some of you have heard classes like this. Some of you may have even given classes like this. So we'll call that Purna. It's good. Something spiritual. And of course, the more advanced you are, the more your musings throughout the day become really far out subject matter. The second way of giving class is that you read the verse in purport. You take one sentence from the purport. And you riff off of that. And you just tangent to your heart's content. But if somebody says, hey, you're going off track. So then, no, it's based on this sentence. And this is easy to do, surprisingly. And we'll just do a little test, have a little fun, if you guys are game. But because we're Vedantins, and we have a Samanvaya, which is that everything comes from one source, you can pretty much connect any dots you want to. In like one or two sentences. So I just want to get two people. Just somebody think of something completely random, like a purple grasshopper. Any random thing out of nowhere. It can be real, imagined, like whatever. Just something. Somebody. Yes. All right, elephants. Elephants. Good. Somebody give me something else which is as unrelated to elephants as humanly possible. Water heaters and elephants. Water heaters and elephants. Now what I'm going to go for a trifecta here. I'm going to try and connect this verse with water heaters and elephants. Okay? This verse is about an old man too attached and he can't give things up. So we may not be related, like we may not be doing exactly what Paranjan is doing. But you know what? I'm staying over in my apartment and the water heater is very small and the water goes out when I'm getting ready for Mangalarti because I take a hot shower now that I'm a big enjoyer of Grihamedi. And it disturbs me. And in the same way that Paranjan wasn't able to tolerate, I'm not able to tolerate, and I have to learn my lesson from this in my own way. I have to apply it in my own life. And not be so attached to having an unlimitedly big water heater like I do in my nice place in Laguna Beach. I have to do at least some tapasya. But even more important than that, we have to avoid the hati mata. We have to avoid the mad elephant offense. And we have to avoid making Vaishnava aparad. So even if you can't do this one tapasya, at least do that tapasya and don't make Vaishnava aparad. Hare Krishna. And then this way we could take the story and we can link it to anything we want to, and it like actually kind of works. That's way number two. Way number three is you just take it as a given, like in geometry, that every single purport to every single verse in the Bhagavatam was written by Prabhupada to illuminate the meaning of that verse. And after getting enough context, dive into that purport and realize that there's really two things going on in the translation and purport. There's the direct Sanskrit verse and there's Prabhupada's commentary. And your goal as a speaker is to connect the verse to Prabhupada's translation. That's your job. And we'll go through the verse like that. When the Yavanas were taking away King Bharanjana to their place, that's all literal. Binding him like an animal. It says like an animal. It doesn't say binding. But if you lead somebody away like an animal, it means you're leading him away and he's bound. And so Prabhupada, to explicate the flavor of the verse, opted not for a literal translation, but he added the idea of binding because it clarifies really what's implicit in the verse, but what it would escape you if you did a literal translation. You follow? He added an extra verb. They led him away, they took him away, and they bound him like an animal. It's just an adverb. It says like an animal. So he was led away like an animal, but indicates you're led away and you're bound, and Prabhupada, being a brilliant Sanskritist and a superlative Vaishnava, wanting to make this very, very clear for us, he added in that extra language. That's actually part of his purport. It's there in the verse, there's no question. It's a very minimal purport, but Prabhupada is demonstrating his brilliance as an exegete, as a transmitter of spiritual truth. The king's followers became greatly aggrieved while they lamented they were forced to go along with him. That actually comes out in the next verse explicitly. It just said they went with him, but they're forced to go with him. It's actually directly stated in the next verse, and so Prabhupada is pulling from the second verse to give us a little bit more information than this one. And it says Esha he, but then Prabhupada mentions Paranjana by name so that we don't lose our track. In this way, you can see within Prabhupada's translations his very merciful clarifications. And most of our acharyas, they wrote in Sanskrit. So you get their tika, and they have the verse, and then they give a Sanskrit commentary. Prabhupada had this extra thing of an English translation, and so he had an extra time to go through and unpack things. Sometimes you'll see Prabhupada doesn't translate something in the translation, and he spends a lot more time on it in the purport, because he wants to really explain it. Sometimes he'll double translate a word in the translation, because several translations of a word are given by the acharyas. This word means this, this word means this, and so he'll honor two or three of them in the verse. Sometimes it's one thing in the word by word, one thing in the translation, and another one in the purport. Sometimes it's a two-line verse, and he gives like a three-paragraph translation. Usually because there's some possibility of interpreting a verse in a Mayavad way, and he wants to make sure you don't get off the ground with that. He wants to nip it in the bud, so he puts it right up there. This was a very tame translation. Very conservative. Really expert. But Prabhupada does all these things. And the job of the class giver is to notice those things and point them out. And one thing you get when you do that is you end up really starting to see the verses the way Prabhupada does. You kind of train yourself. And so that's the purpose of giving class. Otherwise, you're just giving a speech, which is good too. But if you're going to read Prabhupada's verse in purport, which he wanted us to do, then do it. Give Prabhupada the honor of the first place. Find out what he was saying first. Then after you've done that, unpack that sufficiently, you can go on to some secondary, tertiary points if you want to. So I want to go through the purport like this. When Yamaraj and his assistants take a living entity away to a place of judgment. So again, Yama has been swapped out for Yavana based on Vishwanath Chakravarti's commentary. The life, air, and desires being followers of the living entity also go with him. It just says Anupatta. It doesn't tell you who the followers are. So immediately our acharyas have to jump on that, and they have to tell you what that indefinite word means. You follow? So sometimes, like I just said, followers. So which followers? Which specific followers? So if it's not stated directly in the verse, then that's one of the first things our acharyas will do. This word means this. And it kind of doesn't make any sense. The life, so the living entity is taken away, and the life, air, and desires go with him. What is a living entity but his life? It appears redundant. prima facie, at a first reading, Prabhupada's purport appears to be redundant. It says here the living entity goes. The living entity is life. Along with that living entity, life, life air, and desires go. Life is a living entity. You follow? So it would appear to be redundant. So we have to figure out, what does that mean? By the way, does anybody want to? I know, because I read. I figured it out. I read some different commentaries and figured it out. Anybody want to guess what that means? Do you guys see the problem? Living entity is life. Life is life. It's redundant. There's a fault. Life is consciousness. Excellent. That's great. So now let's just say life. We're going to take that term life, and we're going to interpret it so it's different than the living entity. So the living entity, of course, the living entity is chit anu. It's a particle of consciousness. So we could make that more difficult. If the living entity is chit anu, if it's a particle of consciousness, then it is consciousness. No, so life is the symptom. I was interpreting what he said. Do you want to continue? Maybe I misunderstood you. Let me try and repeat what you've said. He's saying that life is the symptom of the soul. And so then what's being described is that the symptom of life left with him. Of course, if life was the symptom of life, that's an interpretation of life. Because I say when it says life here, it means the symptom of life. Then that would be an interpretation, because the direct word would be life. And wait, I'm going to run with it for a second. If I say, when the living entity leaves the body, right, life leaves the body. Is that redundant? I'm asking. When a living entity leaves the body, life leaves the body. Is that saying the same thing twice, or is there a difference between those two statements? It adds a variety. It adds a variety. How? Be equal to death. So it clarifies. It clarifies the meaning. Okay. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur mentions that when the living entity leaves, prana leaves. Prana is often translated as life or life air. But then there's also four other pranas. There's udana, vyana, samana, and apana. There's four other life airs. So Vishwanath says prana leaves, and then the other four subsidiary pranas leave. And when I read this in relationship to that, to me that fit like a glove. I think your explanation is also reasonable. I don't think it's wrong. But I wasn't quite satisfied with life leaving and the living entity leaving, because what is the living entity but its life? What is the living entity but its consciousness? And so when I read this, I was appreciating it. So they're looking at anupata, the life airs and desires. The follower is left, prana is the follower, and then also all the other life airs, and one's desires, one's sukshma sharira goes along with it. This is confirmed in the Vedas. Prabhupada gives a proof text. He quotes the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. Tam utkramantam prano utkramati pranam anutkramantam sarve prana anutkramanti. And this verse is far out because it mirrors the language of the Bhagavatam verse. It's quoted by Vishwanath Chakravarti again, and Prabhupada, he breaks it down and explains it. But it says almost the same thing that the verse does, and it really impacts us. And it again does the same thing. It says, prana anutkramati. Prana also departs, also goes. And then prana anutkramantam. When prana goes, sarve prana anutkramanti. All the pranas go. So when prana goes, all the pranas go. Again, making a distinction between two kinds of pranas. When the living entity life air are gone, the lump of matter produced by five elements, earth, water, fire, air, and ether is rejected and left behind. The living entity then goes to the court of judgment, and Yamaraj decides what kind of body he's going to get next. This process is unknown to modern scientists. Every living entity is responsible for his activities in this life, and after death he's taken to the court of Yamaraj, where it's decided what kind of body he'll take next. Prabhupada mentions Yamaraj judging you five times in this purport. That scientists don't know this. So, you know, on one reading, you could read it that the scientists don't know that Yamaraj is in charge of living entities, and that when you die, Yamaraj takes you to his court and judges you and then sends you to an appropriate place according to what you've done in this lifetime. I'm doubtful that scientists are going to figure that one out anytime soon. From an epistemological point of view, I have a really hard time even conceiving how I would introduce the concept of Yamaraj to a scientist. It seems like a real ambitious proposal. I think that what Prabhupada is intending here when he says this is he means that the idea that the body is separate from the life force, that consciousness is separate from the body, that when you die, it's not all over. This basic pillar of theism is what he's referring to. So to some extent, I think that, you know, that provides us with a much more tangible thing we could get into with a scientist, if we want to explain. Whenever I have a task put before me, I usually like to figure out how will I know if I've accomplished that, or how will I go about accomplishing, what would constitute proof of being able to show somebody that. And so showing Yamaraj is judging all living entities to someone who doesn't already accept the entirety of the Vedas is a difficult task. However, showing that life is separate from the body, that has much more powerful arguments to support it. And so I think that's what Prabhupada's talking about in a general sense. And you can take some of those details and streamline them to get to what Prabhupada's talking about. All right. So I'm just sort of getting warmed up. This was all like making sure we were all on the same page. My actual class was going to start right about now. But I think he's telling me I should finish. We can stop. I'll just give you guys like a little, because I don't want to take too long of your valuable time. You've been so kind to listen to me speak. And we can maybe take a couple of questions, or people can make contributions if they want to. But where I was going to head with this, I was going to attempt what I think is a very tight argument for how the soul is different from the body. So I was going to offer you guys what I think might be a nice service to put this out. Prabhupada can't write everything in every purport, because in every purport would be the entirety of everything he said. So he picks and chooses what he's going to say in a given purport. And then one of the jobs of the class giver is then to kind of fill in the blanks and sort of extend it and go on with it a little bit, pulling from other places. So I was going to offer you guys a really streamlined, the best argument I've ever found, or one of the best, and definitely one of the simplest, for explaining how the soul is different from the body. That said, it's slightly technical. So I'm going to skip over doing that. The next thing I was going to do was I was going to explain how there are three ways to understand this pastime and this verse. One way is just, this is about us. We are Paranjana. We're too attached to this material world, whether it be to water heaters or going to various exotic places of pilgrimage other than our primary places of pilgrimage, going on too many tirthayatras, whatever it might be. We're attached to, you know, we want to go to India, we want to see, you know, exotic sites, so we can kind of put that on our bucket list of things we've done in this lifetime, as opposed to hearing and chanting, which is the real purpose of going to a tirtha. And so we're all Paranjanas in our own way. And I can give you one simple example. I was a brahmachari for 6-7 years. I practiced brahmacharya for 10 years. I was a brahmachari in the temple for 6-7 years. And so I was in Japan in the wintertime, living in a van, taking ice baths, distributing books for 14 or 16 hours a day, giving all the money to the temple, which is sort of a kind of a leitmotif of my life somehow or other. And so I'm there, I'm a brahmachari, serving my guru in some far-off place, performing great austerities, living very simply and giving everything. And in that place, I remember that one of my primary concerns was how many books I distributed compared to the people I was traveling with, and where my name was in the World Sankirtan newsletter. I'd read that World Sankirtan newsletter with great eagerness every month when it came out to see my name, see how I did, see who I was better than. And I thought, you know, I'll become known as a great devotee because I'm doing all this seva. So I kind of had like this wonderful opportunity to practice pure devotional service, and I managed to screw that up. You want to find out the quality of someone's bhakti? Look at the results. If they're a brahmachari one day and then they become a big grihastha the next day, there was something else going on besides pure devotional service. Anyway, so in our life there's all sorts of ways in which we can directly derive meaning from the story of Paranjana. The second benefit, the second way to take this story, and this is also given by Prabhupada and Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur and our acharyas, is that these verses aren't for us. We don't worry so much about these things. We have faith in Krishna. We do the right thing. We do our seva if we're liberated. If we're not, Mukunda Datta, I was going to tell the story of Mukunda Datta, na dhanam na janam na sundarim, that the Lord takes everything away if He favors you. Prabhupada's life story, the very principle of bhakti is that we leave things to Krishna. And we don't worry so much about this. And jara, old age, doesn't affect devotees. Just brings them closer to Krishna. And so another way with merit to understand this is that this particular story of Paranjana, especially as we advance in devotional service, this isn't for us. This isn't for us. The raw story. But we can take it and we can refine it. We can find something in there, some little extra attachment, not based on fear. Not based on fear. In the beginning, your practice of devotional service is based on Shastriya Shraddha, you have faith in the Shastras. Later on, it's the Lakshana is Lobhutpati. It's the Lakshana is that there's a rising of just sincere love for Krishna. You know, if I serve you because I'm afraid you're going to punish me, it's good. If you're a criminal, laws are there for criminals so they won't commit criminal acts. But for sane, healthy, functional people, they do the right thing because they want to. And so we might take some of these lessons from Paranjana, but it's not based on this fear model of that we're going to get dragged down to hell, we're worried about our next lifetime, etc., etc. It's based on that we want to love Krishna in the best way possible, and Krishna's pleased when we become more pure in our seva. And so we're purifying ourselves for Krishna's pleasure instead of to avoid some negative circumstance. The bulk of my class is going to be spent doing that. And the final point I wanted to make was that this whole story can be reinterpreted, and it is, by our acharyas, including Srila Prabhupada, starting the next chapter, as being about bhakti. Paranjana became Vaidarbhi. Becoming Vaidarbhi is him becoming a devotee. Because Vaidarbhi married Malayadvaj, who is the chief of the devotees who are like sandalwood paste. He's the flag, the dvaj of Malayas, of the sandalwood trees, the great personalities. And so her marriage to Malayadvaj represents satsanga. It represents satsanga. Then they have a child. The child is asitekshana, which means one who's glanced at by the blue. So the child of that sadhu sangha is that you're favored by Krishna. And then that child marries Agustya, who represents the mind. Hustya brings together Aga, that thing which can't act on its own, the mind which requires the senses in order to act. And now the mind becomes involved in that process. And then they have children. And those children are the seven processes of devotional service, which naturally give rise to Sakyamanatmi Vedanam, the final two. And like this, it just goes on and on. And the whole story of Puranjana is interpreted as being a story of how someone comes to bhakti. And this whole first part is just becoming frustrated with material life so that when you get the sadhu sangha, you can appreciate it. In this way, we can take this story in three distinct ways. We can point by point. I'm making mistakes. I'm like Puranjana. And that's healthy. It's humble. I need to purify myself. We're all like Puranjana. The second way is, I'm a devotee. I see these stories. I want to get away from a fear-based relationship with God. Fear-based relationships aren't with Krishna. They're with Vishnu. If you're worshiping Krishna, you can't have a fear-based relationship. And then finally, we can understand this whole story becomes beautiful and wonderful. It's a story of devotion. And we've all become Vaidharbhi. Because we've all fallen into the good association of devotees by the grace of the Lord, sometimes despite ourselves, and we're blessed with these wonderful opportunities to practice devotional service, and everything becomes auspicious. Okay, that's what I was going to talk about, but at least I paid a little bit of an homage to it. I at least did something with it. It's 9:10. I don't want to keep anybody, so thank you all very much for your kind attention. If there's so anybody who wants to leave is free to leave. Otherwise, we'll take one or two comments or questions. Yes, Prabhu. Sure. And I think you should go and do that seva. I'm a pragmatist, and so when I see a task, I immediately think about it. I'd say this. Prabhupada spent a heck of a lot more time talking about the difference between spirit and matter. And he mentions here, when the living entity and life air are gone, the lump of matter produced by five elements is rejected and left behind. That seems to be a more major theme, macro theme in Prabhupada's teachings. Therefore, I felt justified in making that point. But I certainly think it's okay if somebody wants to go down the Yamaraj route. I just don't feel so bold. Anything else? Actually didn't mention the Sherman movement, but we've talked about it before. I did. I mentioned all the various Gnostic traditions, yeah, and kind of peripheral Vedic, the Kashians and the Avadhuts, those are all Vedic words. He's asking about a time frame. There's two time frames. There's our traditional time frame, and there's our traditional time frame. Mahatattva Prabhu asked about the time frame for the Baudas and the Shramans and the Kashians and the Avadhuts and the Tantrics and the Yogis. And so there's two time frames. There's a traditional one and then there's a academic one. So which one do you want? I'm going to indirectly answer your question, taking a page out of the Bhagavatam. I'm going to indirectly answer your question, feeling inspired by Puranjana. I'll say this. When spirit meets matter, a timestamp is placed on spirit. If somebody teaches, like for instance, you know, somebody teaches you're not the body, somebody comes up with that on their own, that idea is eternal. But 5,000 years ago, 500 years ago, 5 days ago, somebody may come up with it. That doesn't make it any less spiritual. Doesn't make it any less eternal. Just like Newton's laws of classical physics, they weren't created when Newton discovered them. He just noticed them and put his name on them. So we put our name on a piece of land, on a set of laws, but those laws pre-exist. Shastra is created at a certain point in time, but we say it's aparusheya. we say it's not created. We say it's eternal. It's eternal because the truth contained therein is eternal. Whether it was spoken 5 days ago or 5 million years, there were stupid people millions of years ago. And there's smart people today. And so we should look for the truth of something as opposed to becoming overly concerned with when it was put together. However, I appreciate your question. And as soon as class finishes, we can discuss it for as long as you want. Just being sensitive to the time and how long it would take for me to give, like, actually answer your question properly, I decided to go that route. Any final points? Yes, Prabhu. The mentality of what it means to have purified seva. Yeah, I mean, that's something devotees have a lot of experience with. I think anybody here could answer that question. Prabhupada was installing the Radha Krishna deities in Los Angeles in 1970. And he was giving a lecture. And he was trying to explain to the deities how they should worship the first Radha Krishna deities in our movement. And he looked at Krishna, and he began to cry. You can hear it on the tape. He said, "My dear Lord, I'm very fallen, I'm very lowly, but I brought this little thing for you. Please accept it." And he was preaching to the devotees, saying, "What is the value of your things? It is nothing. Simply you have to say, like, you know, because everything already belongs to Krishna. Isha vasyam idam sarvam. Everything already belongs to Krishna. And so, when we offer something to Krishna, the only thing we can really offer is our bhakti, our love. At a certain point, you just love Krishna. Whether you're liberated, whether you spend a few more lifetimes in this material world, whether you go up or down, whether you suffer, you enjoy, those things become less relevant. And the guiding light of your life is, can I give some pleasure to Krishna? I really just want to make Krishna happy. I really want to please Krishna, and I want to please those people through whom Krishna has manifested himself. Krishna Roop and Krishna Swarup, my Guru Jana." And that becomes kind of the major macro theme of your life, and everything else becomes a detail until eventually it dissipates altogether, and all that's left is that pure feeling. Final points? So we'll finish with that. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.